Hello, everyone, and welcome back to We Are Here Tomorrow. Across from me is John.
Hello.
I'm Zach. And this is our podcast, as always. Welcome back to our newest episode, episode 4. Before we launch into the actual topics, we just want to do some meta conversation, some housekeeping stuff, just to address some of the feedback that we got from episodes 1, 2, and 3. John, is there anything you wanted to add? Otherwise, I'm going to launch into some of the notes that I got.
Please do, Zach. Please.
All right. So, for starters, all the feedback we got was awesome, and it was so cool to hear what everybody had to say about our podcast. I want you guys all to know that not only can you guys send us text messages, emails, talk to us in person, but you can actually respond to the podcast itself just at the same webpage, or same email address, rather, that we use for the newsletter. If we've got a fact that you feel we spoke on incorrectly, we're here to learn with everyone else. So we would love to hear anything that any facts that we got wrong. John and I aren't going to pretend like we become experts in the 2 weeks of in between episodes. So yeah, you guys know something that we don't know, please let us know. We would love to share it with the rest of the audience.
And just for clarity, that email address is wearehere.tomorrow@gmail.com. You can also find it in the show notes or on social media, whatever you find.
Right on. Exactly. The only other note that I wanted to make, and this is something for me alone, John has got his stuff figured out as usual. My audio quality, some of you may have noticed, was fuzzy or tinny in the teaser episode, then much clearer in episodes 1 and 2, and then returned to the tinniness in episode 3. I've been doing a little bit of experimentation with the type of mic I have, so hopefully we've got it figured out now, and that will not be a problem moving forward.
That being said, podcasts are notorious for having AV issues, and the audio is buggy here and there, so hopefully we don't have too much of that at all, but I hope our voices are coming in crisp and clear.
We've given it our best shot, so if any of you guys are audiophiles out there and have suggestions, again, let us know. All right, so now that we've swept up a little bit and the housekeeping is all done, let's talk about our topic today.
Yeah, what are we talking about, Zach?
Yes, we're going to talk about some content moderation. John, would you, like, how much would you say that your social interaction is done in person versus over, like, a social media network? Just ballpark estimate.
Yeah, let's see. I don't know, maybe half and half. There's a lot that I try and interact with in messages, direct messages on social networks, whatnot. I don't post a lot, honestly, but there's a fair amount in person here and there too, of course, and that's probably the preferred, but just due to convenience, social media is definitely prevalent.
Totally, yeah. 50% was kind of the number that I nailed down as well, which is crazy to me to actually think about that. Almost half of my interactions with other humans is not face-to-face, is not even by note, by letter, anything like that. It's via the internet. It's via electronics. So going off of that, that's a medium that, unlike spoken word, sticks around forever. So when we're looking at the content that is always out there, not all that content is good, am I right? Like, we both know that.
True. So, people regret things. Things change.
Right, exactly. And not only do people regret things, but there are also people that that purposely put out things that are hateful, demeaning, and just negative in general. So that's what we really want to talk about today. How these large platforms are actually controlling the content that is on their space, and what that says. What are the legal ramifications? What are the social ramifications? And what we kind of see in the future? Because certainly, this communication and this divide is not going away. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. True.
Sweet. So on that note, let's kind of establish and scope in what we mean when we actually say content moderation. It's really important to ground the conversation, or to ground this in what that means. And we really want to divide that from the nebulous content. So for example, fact checking is something that I know when I think of content moderation, I also think of somebody saying that post is true or that post is false. That is not what we're going to be talking about today. Today, we're going to be talking about, like I mentioned earlier, that hateful speech, as well as any violent or sexually explicit posts that are made on these social networking sites.
Right, and we're also going to be talking about some of the gray areas. So not just the illegal stuff, but stuff that certain parties of power want taken down, either due to it being hate speech, like you mentioned, or it being against someone's rules. There's a lot of gray areas in there, and it definitely depends on what nation you're in, etc. We're going to get into all of those details.
Right, and a lot of people I know look at content online and say, is it really that big of a deal what people say online? Let people be people. Who cares? It's online. It's not the real world. And we're here to say that there are some very real life consequences of some of these online comments. For example, Facebook has been put under some enormous humanitarian pressure. In this past March, the United Nations has blamed Facebook for the spread of hatred for the Rohingya minority. Facebook also had to temporarily be shut down in Sri Lanka after some mobs were incited around the Muslim minority in the country. There are some very real tendrils that come off these online applications.
As well as those are definitely big, huge nation level, cultural level. But I think you and I, there's some things that we take for granted. You and I, and probably most of the people that are listening to this, are probably in the majority in a lot of opinions, or their opinions aren't too inflammatory, so they don't get a lot of approaches. They don't get a lot of attention and negativity because they're relatively common opinions. You could look into the Overton window if you want to look into some cool theories behind that. But there are some groups that hold opinions that are fair and valid in a lot of ways. And they might not be as popular of opinions, but they're not abhorrent, they're not crazy, they're not harming people, but they're easy to condemn, or maybe they're marginalized in a different way because it's an old term, and that old term they've reclaimed as their own, and they can't use that because it's seen as negative. There's other ways that it affects you and I, and ultimately, you and I, we all want to be able to operate as freely and reasonably as we can. We don't want to be wronged for anything that is clipped out by a giant big tech company.
Right. And I know, too, when I was looking at this, from the time that I spend online, I don't encounter a ton of, like, to use your word, abhorrent content. I don't come across a ton of extreme violence or sexually explicit content or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that it's out there, right? Or that it's not out there, correct?
Right. It's definitely out there. And I think what you're getting at is that there are just bad apples out there. Or yeah, people right, do right. bad things. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you and I, we're good apples, right? Like, I'm a good, like, Fuji apple, definitely.
I question whether Fuji is a good apple, but go on.
fair. We can moderate your content out later. That's fine. But yeah, there's really kind of a theological assumption there, is that everyone online is inherently a good apple, or everyone, the entire community is inherently good. If that were truly the case, we wouldn't be having this content that needed to be moderated. Or even if that content got out there, the good apples that are in the community are going to immediately weed that out and not propagate this data or this content. The problem is we know that that's not true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's definitely, not only do you have one bad apple that may be pushing content to a group of otherwise good apples, but we also have two bad apples working together and knowingly and purposefully trading around this abhorrent content.
Right. You always see people like to be around people that are like them. So us good apples are sticking together. We're not into these crazy fringe beliefs that are frowned upon and just terrible, rightfully so. But there are people that are a tiny minority, but they can find each other far more easily online. So there are communities of crazy, unhealthy ways of life and sharing of content that we don't see. There's bad apples that collect with other bad apples.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so not only do these social networks, and not only do we as a culture want to get rid of these random acts of bad applery in otherwise a community of good apples, but we also want to crack down on this very purposeful and illicit trade between two bad actors, right?
Right.
So how do we actually do that? And what are the big players here?
Yeah, so I think it's worth, as we help you understand what content moderation is a little bit better and how it works right now, I think it's worth thinking about a single piece of content. And of course, content moderation actually was a topic before the internet, but the internet really brought it into existence. And one of the huge powers of the internet, different from the media from before, is that there aren't gatekeepers anymore. If you, Zach, 40 years ago wanted to post something and have thousands, millions of people see it, you would have to go to a newspaper, a magazine, the TV news, whatever it might be, in order to get your content out there. So there would, of course, be layers of friction to have people approve your piece of content, your message, etc. That's no more. There are no more gatekeepers. So instead, we have this frictionless or friction minimized world where you and I can just immediately put something onto the internet. And now with social media, of course, we can put something into a social network, which can then be automatically shot to all of our friends and family and whatnot, whoever we're connected with, and even people that we're not, as things get reshared. So
right. I've kind of heard it kind of related very much to the printing press, like to the revolution of the printing press, right? Where prior to the printing press, it was really hard to take a thought from my head and get it out to the population or to the public. I had to find my paper, cut my own paper, bind my own books, write it, all this kind of stuff. And that was a huge hurdle. And then when the printing press came around, all of a sudden that obstacle to getting your thoughts out there was vastly diminished. We could mass produce these thoughts and give them out hundreds and thousands at a time to groups of people. Social media is, again, that lowering of the bar where it is so easy for me to have a thought, type it out on my little smartphone, and send it out literally to the entire world in the span of 30 seconds.
Right. Or even you could think of memes potentially lowering that bar even further by making it even easier to take an already existing structure of communication and plug your thoughts into it. I've never thought about that, but you could consider social media playing to the memes as spreading content far and wide.
Right. So that's where the word meme actually comes from. I don't know if you... Yeah, so meme is in memetics, which is like a singular packet of information and how that information spreads.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I found out about that a little while ago, and I was like, oh, it's not just a stupid name. Interesting.
Okay. Random fact. Okay.
Right.
So maybe it's worth us walking through the path of a piece of content and how moderation fits into that. So So the first group that's worth focusing on are those, the users and the institutions. So you and I, Zach, our audience, institution being, you know, let's say NPR or anyone out there, anyone that has, you know, an institution behind them, they're posting content. So posters posting content. And then that content, you can either directly find it. I could go to your Facebook or your Twitter or your YouTube site, and I could find your pieces of content, or that content is served up to us by a news feed of sorts. So that's just a mechanism to then allow the users, you and I, and all the people, not the institutions, that frequent Facebook and social media networks, YouTube, etc., to then see the content. So there is a little bit of a mechanism of serving content, but really that whole notion of no gatekeeper is still true, where someone can post and immediately another person can see that content. So then there's two ways that this content can get flagged. One way is moderated, and it's through flagging. Mm-hmm. Flagging is this verb where you and I are able to, almost like in football, throw a flag on the play.
Okay. So
on the play, we're throwing a flag on the content, saying that there is an issue.
Right. So like, let's say I type up something, it is inflammatory, it should be moderated out. So then this flagging happens, right?
Yeah. So like in Instagram, for example, there is a button that you can click, and maybe there's a sub option in there, whatever, you can click flag or needs review, whatever the phrasing is. All the platforms have that. And that's just one way the flagging happens. And I guess we'll continue that thought quickly. Once it's flagged, it's sent to Facebook for moderation. And we'll get into what that looks like. But another way content is flagged is not through the users flagging it. They're always free to do that. But now you'll see the Facebooks and YouTubes of the world trying to create machines, algorithms that automatically look at and try and understand what the posts are saying. No matter, you know, if you posted it, I posted it, institutions, some of high risk, some of low risk, they look at all of it theoretically and try and flag the content that their algorithm, operated by no humans, thinks is bad. So there's two ways to flag content.
Okay, so humans and machines.
Correct, humans and machines. So then after YouTube, Facebook, whoever is alerted that this content is potentially worth reviewing and taking off the platform, then it goes to a third party. So Facebook, YouTube, especially those two are the biggest two in the space. They have tens of thousands of workers now who are the humans that do the review for this. So if I flag a piece of your content, Zach, I think it's bad, or if a machine does, then mm-hmm. it will go to five of these human reviewers independently. So they'll all be sitting at their own station, and the picture will flash on their screen. They have been trained with the community guidelines, whatever rules they're enforcing, and they will then decide yes or no, this should stay, this shouldn't stay. After those five or so people review it, there might be a tiny bit of leveling out of trying to make sure that the final decision is unanimous. Maybe someone was slightly different and they have to consult the rules. But eventually a final decision is made.
Okay.
And this final decision is then propagated back, basically sent back to the pool of content where your and my tweets and YouTube videos sit, and it can be removed. Just fully removed, and we can be alerted that our content has been removed. So that's basically the loop as what content moderation is. Of course, people don't like content moderation decisions at times. They want to contest that no, their post should stay on the platform. So what they can do is appeal.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. And so if I'm on the other end of one of these bad tweets, and I think I want to sue, what happens? Can I just go do that? Or
right. So that's not the type of appeal that is possible. The type of appeal are basically, think of them as internal appeals. So within Facebook, you can tell Facebook, hey, review this again. I don't think you're right. I honestly don't know exactly how much you can say. I don't think you can like submit documents to prove that things should go your way, but they will review your case eventually, and they can decide that you're right, your content should be back online, and they can, you know, put it back into the system for other people to see, etc. You can't sue people. Let me introduce this first. So
okay,
that process, that appeal process, very much controlled by Facebook or YouTube or whoever. But Facebook is, through some pressure and through some, I guess, innovation, however you want to think about it, Facebook is thinking about making a Supreme Court, quote-unquote, of sorts, where the people that make the decision on that court, instead of being hired and hand-selected by Facebook, Theoretically, the people will have more of a third-party viewpoint. They won't always have the Facebook fiduciary money-making context in mind, and it can be maybe a more independent review of your appeal. That doesn't exist yet, but and it won't be able to review all documents. They'll, you know, accept a certain number of cases to review in depth and probably use that information to then re-inform their community guidelines. But that's coming down the pipeline too, which is really interesting. The third thing that you just mentioned mm-hmm. is suing a company. So if you, Zach, had your piece of content removed, you thought it was unlawful, and you wanted to sue YouTube, Facebook, whatever it might be, you actually can't. And the reason you can't is because in, the 1990s, I want to say, there was a piece of legislation that was created known as CDA 230.
Okay.
And this is the 26 words that created the internet, which in short, they allow or they prevent people from suing social media platforms for their content moderation if they think they can, if they are the content, the platforms in good faith taking down content or moderating in some other way, then there is no liability that the Facebook and YouTube's the world hold. Does that make sense?
Gotcha. Yes. Yes, it does. So I think that Recode Decode podcast. So if anyone wants to look more into the CDA 230, John and I took a look at Recode Decode episode 410 with Kara Swisher. And it's absolutely fantastic in terms of informativeness on what this actually, what the playing field is around the CDA 230.
Yeah, what can you tell us about it? Maybe some of the history. I know that is pretty well known and out there, and some of the current trends.
Yeah, so this was, it's obviously relatively new because social media hasn't been around that long, but it goes back to the 1950s about moderation of actual like bookstore content, for example. Bookstores were coming under fire for having possibly selling inflammatory material. So what happened was that the stores at the outset weren't required to actually moderate the content that was in them, right? So you could sell a book that maybe spoke favorably of, let's say, Nazism. And while that's not culturally acceptable, that was legally acceptable to the bookstore because they should not be responsible for the actual content of their books.
And was part of that due to you start up a bookstore tomorrow, you have thousands of books in your repository, and you're not expected to read and know all of the arguments put forth in that. Is that magnitude part of it, or it was more along the lines of a freedom to sell content?
I think it's kind of both. So, yeah, number one, you weren't expected to take responsibility for that content. And number two, it was very much like a free market thought, whereas like, if the bookstore has a bunch of these inflammatory, abhorrent books, no one's going to want to go there. Like, it's going to go out of business. So it puts some of that onus capitalistically on the bookstore to, yes, we maybe can't read every single word in the bookstore, but we can give it a shot, and we should be pretty good about it, and the market should be driving us, should be driving that bookstore to do that.
Okay. So bookstores.
Yeah. So
in the 1950s.
Right. So then we skip forward to the 1990s when, you know, the internet's starting to take off. And you kind of see this same problem on steroids. There were two court cases that highlighted one side versus the other. The Recode Decode podcast goes into this. I recommend that. I can't recommend that enough. So CompuServe was our first player in this game. It was essentially just an early forum server. It just had just stored content for its users. They had absolutely no content moderation. They just hosted the data for their users and hosted the forums. You now have another company called Prodigy, who was doing some of the same things, but they were really involved with having family-friendly content. So, because of that, they were going out and kind of putting their stamp of approval and saying, we are moderating this content for family friendliness. we are going to make sure that there's not abhorrent content on here. So both of those companies had defamation lawsuits taken out of them. Essentially, that there was something slanderous put out on their network. And there were two very different outcomes of these cases. CompuServe, which again was the server farm, essentially, that was just hosting these forums, and they were not promising any content moderation. Their case was dismissed because they purposefully didn't exercise any of that editorial control. So just like the bookstore, they weren't expected to control that information.
And as another comparison, they weren't a publisher. They weren't the NPR and, you know, making a stance and making statements. They were just hosting and distributing content. Is that a fair way to frame
it? Yeah. It's even like one step back from a bookstore. Like, imagine a bookstore that you could just go put any book you wanted into. So it's even one step further removed from that moderation.
It's like
process.
Those little libraries that sit on the street corner where anyone can walk up and put in a book or take out a book.
And for the record, if you go into those, they're just full of sexy romance novels. So, yeah. Not that I'm checking. But anyway, so Prodigy, which was our other more family-friendly player in this game, they were, in fact, charged with defamation because they were claiming that they were adequately moderating their content. And so there was a direct failure to do that. They promised that content moderation, and they weren't able to keep up with the scale. So both these cases caught Congress's attention because they were two very similar players that ended up with very different outcomes of their court cases. And so they eventually set up the Cox-Wyden bill, or CDA 230. And there's two parts of that bill. Or there's two parts of that bill kind of going back to those players. Number one, an interactive computer service like the CompuServe, for example, is not responsible for communication being had between third parties. So, for example, they are hosting a forum. They are not responsible for the content that is directly sent to these forums. The second part, which kind of goes along, with Prodigy and would have protected them in this case, was that these service providers aren't liable for the content as long as they are providing good faith efforts to content moderate. So, for example, if like this publisher, as long as they were giving it a shot, the CDA 230 gives them some protection from defamation lawsuits.
Is it that my understanding, and maybe this is semantics, but is that it's maybe more along the lines of if the content moderation is in good faith, then there isn't any liability. If Facebook were trying to purposefully throw an election, that probably wouldn't be seen as good faith, and they would be liable for something along those lines. But it's still possible for people to do no content moderation, just still be a forum. Is that still okay? Do you know? Maybe this is something we can put in the show notes.
We'll have to look into that. I know that is kind of a fuzzy area if you want to dive into things like 4chan and 8chan, for example, which did 8chan touted that we were not moderating anything.
Right.
And they still were shut down, correct?
Yep. Yeah. They were shut down because a Cloudflare, a provider of, we'll just say, online protection services, it gets confusing, basically withdrew their support. And without those protections, their internet or their hosting was just taken down due to vigilantes, effectively. Anything else you want to talk about for 230?
Yeah, so do I, like, you know, this is obviously a U.S.-only act or bill. Do you know if there's what other nations are doing?
Yeah, so my understanding is that no other nations have a Communications Decency Act 230 of sorts. a lot of other nations are less litigious. The people don't sue everyone like the United States loves to do. So a lot of the power resides in the state to do the fining and suing. But there isn't the same U.S. CDA 230 in other countries for that reason. And because Facebook and YouTube and Twitter are U.S. companies, we basically have been exporting a lot of the CDA 230's rules. What's really interesting about this exportation of technology is it often, if things change, it can be an importation of other technologies or other cultures. So it'll be interesting to see if other nations decide and somehow finagle a different set of rules, as we'll talk about. Could that be somehow imported or affecting U.S. citizens and how we interact with our social medias?
Gotcha. Okay. So we've got kind of these big couple factors in this chessboard, right? We've got companies like Facebook and YouTube and other, I guess, service providers is what we want to call them, social media companies. And then we also have the legislative side of things coming in, stepping in with the CDA 230, protecting these companies from certain litigious acts.
Right. And then you have these other nation states and their governments. And of course, they have some leverage and control, so they can demand some things, as we'll talk about later. But maybe it's useful now to talk about why the current content moderation system isn't all flowers and rainbows. What's kind of wrong with it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a good idea to just like understand how large, what are the numbers behind this content? Like, how much content is out there? Like, how much content is being produced?
Right. And I know for YouTube,
do you have those numbers?
For YouTube, it's about 500 hours are uploaded, 500 hours of new content uploaded every minute.
Holy shit. Sorry, Mom.
That source is even like a little bit old. I'm sure that number is just rising all the time. For Facebook, they have something north of 2 billion monthly users. I think almost 2 billion, 1.6. I think you found this, Zach, are daily active users, meaning they use it every day. So there's a lot of people making comments and posting things on that. You have some other Facebook numbers?
Yeah. So those two numbers from Facebook, I have Facebook relevant sources for those. There's a couple other numbers that I'm not going to go into.
Okay.
But yeah, essentially there's a ton. There's hundreds of thousands of comments and pictures posted every single day on Facebook. So we're talking about, you know, an enormous magnitude of content to moderate.
Right. And because our moderation system depends so much on that flagging mechanism, either by a human, who's probably going to be a little more accurate, even though I've flagged friends' posts because I thought I was being funny, there just isn't enough flagging by humans being done. So the autonomous flagging has to carry a bulk of the weight, as well as, you know, if it's the bad apple to bad apple situation, if bad apple one is sharing a violent extremism video with bad apple two, there's no flagging going on. So the autonomous, the AI flagging, whatever, has to be pretty good. And it has seemed shoddy initially. Honestly, we don't have much as a consumer transparency to how good it is. Back in 2017, YouTube claimed that 98% of the pieces of content that are flagged for violent extremism, 98% of those flags are coming from the autonomous AI systems, meaning that you and I, the humans, are doing only 2% of the work. So,
right. But do we have an idea of like what they're missing?
Right. I mean, yeah, it's easy to say 98%, but we don't know if that 98% should actually be 99.99%, because there's so much violent extremism content out there that it's not missing and letting through the cracks. Or if their flagging is just willy-nilly. I'm sure it's not, but I wonder if the accuracy of those flags are quite good enough for that 98%. To truly be a solid number that we should rely on and see as being very good, very high. It's not like 98% on a test. This is where you need to have an engineering. We talk about the March of the Nines. You need to have 99.99, whatever it needs to be, of the autonomous picking up the slack, because the humans could be realistically only finding 1/1,000,000th of the bad content that's out there. So some other bad things, of course, is that the violent extremism, child exploitation, the abhorrent content that we don't even want to talk about, it still thrives out there. Some of the issues is because the internet has reduced friction, and because these content providers are reducing friction even more, how did Google come to existence? They were a search provider. So you and I could search in their little toolbar and we could find content related to that. Well, whatever we search, it still creates, it's not, whatever we search for is largely blind to what we're trying to find. So it will just find violent extremism videos if that's what we're looking for. And that can be fine if we're trying to do, you know, real research, journalism, whatnot, but most people probably aren't in that situation and they're trying to find that content themselves. So it's pretty easy to search and find for some of this terrible content. Google, Facebook has done a lot better about this. Another thing more recently is that Google and Facebook are very good at recommending content, you know, the news feed, or in Google, you have these deep, deep rabbit holes of content. And that, if you're already searching for some sort of terrible content, they will often recommend other terrible content.
Right.
So you can just get into the inside circle of bad content and stay there. So that content still thrives and still out there, still abused to this day.
Right.
Zach, you've read up a little bit more along the lines of the human content moderations, the tens of thousands of people that I referenced earlier. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with them?
Sure. Yeah. And this is something that has kind of hit the mainstream news cycle within the last, probably the last 6 to 9 months or so. So I think there's a little bit larger of a public eye shined on it right now. But yeah, these are the, these moderator farms, kind of, that they call them. Typically, they are not directly associated with Facebook. They're contracting companies. So we're going to provide a link to this article in the show notes. It's from The Verge, but they do a really good expose on the lives of these, on the very stressful lives of these content moderators at a contracting firm called Cognizant.
Can you tell me why they're so stressful? Like, what's going on? I've heard some pretty terrible things.
Yeah, so they're like I said again, the article is really good and does very much pull on your heartstrings. But essentially, we are putting people into cubes and showing them this abhorrent content all day. I mean, I know there's been once in a very extreme while that I've stumbled across something very violent that shouldn't be on the internet. And it sticks with me for a while. It definitely shakes you when you're not used to it. Now imagine sitting at a computer and every single second, or I think it's about every 5 seconds, you are seeing one of these posts, whether it is violent extremism, whether it's sexually explicit content, whether it's some sort of illicit behavior. It's very psychologically tasking on these people. Not only do they have to sit through hours and hours and hours of this very, very brutal content, they are also, there's really, really high expectations for them in terms of selecting whether content is illicit or not. So for example, Facebook has their standard policies, or their content moderation policies. It's about a 27-page long document, and I didn't personally look into it, but I looked into some of the responses of the people who have actually read this document, and to say the least, it becomes kind of a gray area in some instances. There's, you know, you think of, are we really policing these millions of Facebook posts and billions of Facebook posts with 27 pages? That's got to be really tough to actually do. And if these moderators are not hitting a very high margin of accuracy, they're gone. So it's
right.
So coupled with a very stressful work environment, it's also a very psychologically damaging work environment, and they're having a lot of high turnover, and they're having a lot of people develop these really unhealthy coping mechanisms, like doing drugs at work or having sex in the bathroom and things like that really definitely should not be happening. So from my perspective, and I know this is held by the Verge author as well, this is just absolutely untenable. We cannot keep this up, especially with the amount of posting going into social media is only going to rise. So these moderators, I really see as a Band-Aid.
Yeah, and I think you'll see, I'm surprised you haven't seen actually more pushback from social media users. I think largely because these thousands of people in Arizona and Jacksonville and Manila, you know, this is international for sure, getting paid very little. It's so behind closed doors. There's so little we know about what's going on. And people, you and I, just don't like seeing the trauma of those terrible situations. That's why we don't do our own content moderation. We're not volunteering for our shift every once in a while. So I fear that people are accepting those jobs because they have to, and those human moderators might be here to stay unless we can replace them, and we'll get to talking about that. But needless to say, it's really terrible. They have to see a lot of content. Their conditions are probably getting a teeny bit better, but it's quite terrible. Also, you made a note about they have really high expectations. I just wanted to say, somewhere I read that they can make, I want to say it's 3 mistakes in a month. Otherwise, they get fired. I think that was for the international groups, but that's still pretty terrible level of expectation, where the pressure's on for you to interpret this really extremely gray area content and hope that it still aligns with what the community standards say today, even though they might have been changed yesterday and you don't totally understand the interpretation as it should be.
Yeah, exactly.
Some other limitations for content moderation. This one's more psychological, and I don't have a solution for this. We don't have a solution for many of these, honestly, maybe any. But is that when people get the notice that their content has been banned or removed, they almost always feel marginalized, that they, for some reason, were targeted for their content. There's a paper we'll link to that interviews 500 some of these of people that were had their content removed, and it's quite telling how they react to it. Also, what's tricky is that I can't claim to know the community standards very well, and as I referenced just a moment ago, the community standards, which is a Facebook thing, but YouTube has their own, Twitter, etc. They're moving a lot. You know, these documents get pressure from governments and politicians and super users, so they are moving around. It's a little bit of cat and mouse, but you and I and your everyday people, we don't even really know what is okay and what's not. Most things are probably okay based on what we want to post, but there are definitely fringe things that get clipped out for reasons that seem unsupportable for
right,
a lot of people.
Yeah, looking at this problem, okay, we have like some sort of untenable solution. What's to stop Facebook from continuing to go this way?
Right. So I think it's worth thinking about in these next two sections, YouTube and Facebook, their incentives as platforms, those two being the biggest, but think about this for Twitter, Instagram, etc. And then thinking about the government groups, they're probably the next biggest incentive.
Mm-hmm.
Power and what those two groups' incentives are. So for Facebook and YouTube, it's worth thinking about them as how they make money. And how they make money, sadly, is through advertising. They are first and foremost a brand advertising platform. That's how they've gotten to these, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of value on the stock market. So what they are actually serving isn't you and I. They're serving as content, but they're really serving, quote unquote, advertisers, people who are trying to target certain individuals for selling their consumer goods primarily, or whatever their services.
Right. Like, we're not customer. We're not the client. We're the product.
We're the product. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, take a big consumer company. They're trying to place their ads to the best people and the best contents. That's why Facebook and Google, all these companies, have so much data about us, because these companies, they want to advertise only to people who they think will actually buy their product that they convinced to do such a thing. So they want as much information to target down to the teeniest niche of the population to sell their products. They also want to make sure that their advertisements aren't being placed next to unsavory content. So this abhorrent, terrible content that we've talked about. Advertisers like Disney, when they found out that there's a lot of violent extremism on or maybe it was child exploitation content on YouTube, they pulled all their advertising dollars from YouTube. They didn't want to do advertising
there. I know exactly what you're talking about, yes.
Ever again. So they want to know that their ad is viewed favorably relative to the other things that are around it on the same page. So that means that YouTube and Facebook are incentivized to have enough control over what content is and isn't on their platform. But they also, at the end of the day, they're trying to optimize to keep users on their platforms. The reason that people are going to Facebook and YouTube to advertise is because they have so many people on their platform, and those people stay on the platform for, I don't know, dozens of minutes, hours a day, unfortunately. We talked about 1.6 billion daily active users on Facebook. That's a crazy number.
Yeah, and that's somebody who uses the platform for, I believe it's more than 30 minutes a day.
30 minutes, yeah. If I'm Charmin Ultra and I want to sell my extremely ultra-durable toilet paper, I want to advertise on that platform rather than piece together all these advertising campaigns on, you know, 1,000 other platforms that would need to equate that 1.6 billion daily active users. So having people engaged is the ultimate thing that you and I as a consumer see, but the advertising platforms are pressuring YouTube and Facebook to have information and have just a clean enough environment, but ultimately they want the people on the platform. They want them to see their ad as much as possible to make the advertising cheaper for them, because more advertising just in total will be net per unit of advertising.
Right. And you kind of mentioned the engagement. I think engagement is a really crucial word. Because I know I look at Facebook and I think, oh, they just want likes, you know, or they just want comments or something like that. It's all the above. Facebook doesn't parse out good, bad, indifferent. They just want engagement on their posts. They just want engagement on their platform because they can show that there are visitors to this page, and that's how they then produce revenue from these ad companies.
Totally agree. Should we move on to the governments and what they... Maybe we should start about why they have power. So they have power because they are able to...
Why the government has power, right?
Why the government has power over in this whole content moderation world. They have power because they ultimately care about what is happening. You've seen... I forget which country is exactly, but... was it the something spring? And you see that you can create, people can use social media to create movements. So they want to make sure that the governments, in some sense, want to make sure that those movements aren't ill-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Ill-intentioned can mean a bunch of different things based on what government you are. Some governments, they want to make sure that they aren't opposing the rule of the current regime, where other governments just don't want the hysteria and outbreak that, you know, some governments are hoping to avoid for this coronavirus stuff.
So there is, it's not just Facebook over in one corner and the government's over in another corner, and they're bickering back and forth. There is some level of cooperation between these two players. And I think that's really, especially with Facebook, I know in the wake of the 2016 election, especially a spotlight was shown on Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, especially. So they've kind of been put to task to step up into the limelight and figure some of this stuff out. So recently, and this is just within, I believe, the past month to month and a half, Zuckerberg has been traveling in Europe and meeting with the European Union to discuss how these online platforms should actually be regulated. There's pushes across the globe to have different versions of regulation, And what he's really pushing for is somewhere around this CDA 230. So essentially, Mark Zuckerberg is asking for Facebook to be regulated somewhere between newspapers and telecommunications companies, like a Verizon or like an AT&T.
Does he have views as to like what that entails?
Yeah. So what that kind of entails at a functional level is that a newspaper who has editorial ability, right? There is an editor that is deciding like what's going in this newspaper versus what is not. They have full liability for the content they publish because it is willful to actually enter in that content into a column and put it out to the streets. Versus a telecommunications company, they hold absolutely no responsibility for the messages that they are relaying. So I could send something abhorrent over a text message to someone else, and AT&T or Verizon has absolutely no culpability there, because I'm the actor. They are just the platform or the service provider. So Zuckerberg is aiming for something right in the middle there. And I do think it's worth noting that it's not just him, but there are also the CEO of Alphabet has also met with the EU, and other senior Facebook figures are meeting with the EU to advocate for this regulation, but at the same time try and make it quote unquote fair. Now, depending on who you are, you may think that they're doing the right thing. You may think they're just looking out for number one, which is Facebook or their prospective pocketbooks. I, for one, I think am a little bit more in favor of how Zuckerberg especially is handling this conversation, just because they are not saying that we want no regulation. What they are saying is they're actually welcoming the government in to create a certain amount of regulation or to demand a certain amount of regulation. But the caveat being that they're looking for some aid. I know a lot of people too are looking at this as, Facebook is just trying to save face from 2016. I personally give him props for stepping up and being part of that solution rather than just being a bystander.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there. I also think that I haven't thought too deeply about that specifically and what they are asking for. Do you know if some of their interest seems to be a little self-serving in another way, such as getting the decision out of their hand, or maybe the culpability into someone else's hand? So it's still what they want ultimately, but the work, the decision, the flack can be put into someone else's face. Does that seem, maybe that's off, I don't know, I just see that sometimes happen.
It's essentially what CDA 230 does, right? Is it protects Facebook in some sense from being on the other end of that defamation lawsuit.
Right, fair. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think I personally don't know Zuckerberg's opinions on CDA 230, but from his comments made at the EU, I would assume that is kind of what he's aiming, what Facebook and other companies are aiming for across the world. Now, is that realistic or not? It remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I do think that the culture in each of these different places is extremely different, and it's very indicative of what is going to get passed versus what is not.
Right.
I think you had some notes on here as well as what the differences across the countries are.
Yeah, I just want to call out some other incentives that some of these countries are looking for. Some of them are very... they saw the Christchurch shooting, that shooting that happened in New Zealand and was Facebook Lived and reposted thousands of times and seemingly couldn't get off the internet despite Facebook's best efforts due to the bad appling. But you see a lot of nation-specific regulations based on the past. So Australia is pushing for Facebook to prevent any live streaming of bad content. That seems pretty tough to do. Other things are demanding takedowns within 24 hours, which would mean a very quick review process. And some of those might be 24 hours of posting, not 24 hours of flagging. So that would mean the auto flagging would have to be really strong. Some other stuff is some countries are definitely thinking about using the content moderation as a bargaining chip. So the US right now, there's a bill, and this has happened a bunch, but the current bill is Earn It. And a lot of companies and big tech companies are afraid that one of the stipulations, one of the asks that's outside somewhat of content moderation, but is a factor here, is that Facebook and YouTube would give up and not put in any end-to-end encryption, which is basically, if Zach, you were to send something to me through Facebook, Facebook wouldn't know what it is. Only you would know what it is, and only I would know what it is.
That's something that they're vying for, or that they're lobbying for, or against?
The government doesn't want that to exist, because that would take Facebook, YouTube, et cetera, out of the loop.
Right.
As well as, and depends on, you know, how much you want to look into some weird fringe viewpoints, but some people think that these governments really want a backdoor, key to the archives for all these social media companies, so that if they have lawsuits, they can depend on Facebook, Google location data, whatnot, find someone culpable, prevent national disasters, whatever it might be. And with end-to-end encryption, the key to the back door doesn't exist anymore, because there is no crack in the facade.
Right.
There are now, you know, billions of back doors, but they are only to one person, and you and I hold the key.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't work.
Famously, that kind of concept goes along with, like, the Silk Road and Tor, the Tor network.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, that it was, I think, a little bit of an open secret that while that was kind of touted as being completely anonymous, that the powers that be in the U.S. definitely had a backdoor to tracking some of those bad actors that were doing things on the Silk Road.
I've heard similar things. Some other bargaining chips is some of these countries just want, in a similar way, wants to make the issue more local. So take Pakistan, for example. They approved a bill, put it into law, that would allow Pakistan to force any of these companies to remove content that the government wanted, preventing the live streaming certain content, as well as moving servers within the country, which I don't know too much about. I intuitively think of it as, if the data is in the country, then the country is going to have a little more say over getting a backdoor into that data.
Yeah.
I could be totally wrong. I don't want to be too, you know, crystal ball here. But Facebook, Twitter, and Google actually put a group together called the Asia Internet Coalition that said, hey, we basically will pull out of the country and not offer our services unless you guys make a change, Pakistan back down, and we'll revise those laws. Similar things have happened in Australia and Vietnam. So there's some bargaining going on where the governments want to maintain some semblance of control.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's, you know, seeing those private coalitions, you know, back down whole governments is either really cool or really scary, depending on where you fall in some of your political views.
Definitely. It's something that you would see in a textbook as being possible,
right?
But it is absolutely happening.
So yeah, I mean, that kind of gives a little bit of an outlook or a little bit of an open door onto the possible futures that we see here, right?
Yeah, yeah. Let's go into that. What are some things that we think the future will be shaping up to look like? Where are we tomorrow, Zach?
Sure. Yes, exactly. That is us. So yeah, we had kind of alluded to earlier, that human moderation is probably not the long-term solution, right? We probably should not have thousands of farms of people just staring at absolutely horrendous content all day, every day, you know, ruining their psyche.
Right. I agree with that stance. I don't know if that's going to be the case, but go on.
Right. Yeah, it's an idealistic or idyllic picture to have, but I got my fingers crossed that hopefully that's where we're going. So in order to achieve that, you know, if humans aren't going to do it, that obviously leaves machine learning and some sort of artificial intelligence to do so. So how would they actually do that? We need to start out, and we kind of mentioned this in our last episodes as well, on the terms of the how computers act with context versus how humans act with context. We're really good at like immediately viewing something and immediately being able to parse out context. You know, I can see, for example, a post that if I just looked at it in the ether looks very harassing or demeaning. And then when I look at it in the context between two of my best friends, I understand that they're very clearly being sarcastic with each other. They're very clearly kidding. There's no malicious intent here. That's one of the things that is really, really, really hard to do with machines.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's artistic. They're actually doing some sort of parody, or they're making fun of something, or they're doing journalistic content where they are making commentary on something that is harsh and they're calling it out.
Right. And so that actually brings up a cool research paper that has come out of the Facebook AI group. They have actually, so the Facebook AI group has looked into how do we take these first steps into not necessarily moderating content, but understanding the context of some of this content. So what they're going for is what they call sentiment analysis. So they're looking to parse out like, hey, this was a message sent, or this was a status update sent by someone on Facebook. What does it mean in the context of everything? Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it neutral? Is it aggressive? So they're trying to dip their toe into how we actually do those things. And basically, without getting too far into it, we're at those base steps. So one of the papers that we will definitely put in the show notes looked into natural language processing, essentially pulling that context out, artificially pulling that context out and having a machine understand what's going on.
And specifically in text in that case.
Yes, yes. And so one thing to note is there it's very, very different between like a formal text versus informal text. So for example, dropping a book and running a book through a natural language processor. It's much easier for that algorithm to parse out some of the sentiments in that book because it's a formal text. They've got everything. It's all included.
There is so much context to each individual thing because there's hundreds of pages. Is that the...
Yeah, and like that context is, while they might be, you know, referencing something historical, that contents really is pretty self-contained in that book or in that paper, whatever you want to look at. Facebook, on the other hand, you know, a social media post is one post out of hundreds of millions. So parsing out that sentiment is really, really tough. So for this paper, for example, their goal was really just to track the positivity or negativity of a certain statement. And basically how they're doing that is they develop an algorithm to essentially assign a vector to each statement and assign it some value between -1, which is a negative comment or a negative connotation, and +1, which is a positive connotation.
And this vector, just to clarify, is just a string of numbers. That's all you need to think of. Go on.
The conclusions on this is that they felt pretty confident in, and they were specifically looking at a group of Spanish students as the population. They concluded that they were able to accurately identify overall student sentiment. And the goal was that they could compare a single post to that student's overall sentiment to understand any significant emotional changes. So they still need that context awareness of what the student has been posting for, you know, the past year or past 2 years. And they may see that, oh, this student kind of posts positive stuff pretty much all the time. And then you see one very, very negative post. And that's a red flag saying, oh, this is significant. This is a significant departure from their typical sentiments. But in terms of individual posts, just looking at that post itself, they really we're not there.
Yeah, this seems pretty rudimentary, right? Like if we're trying to make a content moderation decision off this, it seems like you need, I don't know, maybe three more magnitudes of complexity off the top of this.
Yeah, so I mean, just to highlight that, like there were a couple like very basic things that threw off this algorithm. So for example, irony and sarcasm, which I think a lot of people use very often every day, that was detected as extremely negative. And it was just completely unable to detect anything like that. And that is a really complex human emotion or sentiment, I would say. So it's, that is understandable.
And it's complex in, like, sarcasm's tough in person, mm-hmm. and it's even tougher online. You often see in some techie threads, people, when they throw sarcasm after their statement, they'll do a slash S to yes. indicate this is sarcasm, because it's so hard to communicate otherwise.
And, like, another thing that really threw them off, and this blew my mind, but they did go into an exclamation, I guess I understand that, is birthday greetings. So, like, happy birthday on someone's wall is overwhelmingly positive. It's seen as an overwhelmingly positive statement, but, I mean, I can tell you from posting on people's Facebook walls that that's not always the case, right?
You're saying that sometimes it's, like, emotionless. It's like, happy birthday! But it's, like, the expectation is already that there is some relatively positiveness, so it's kind of, like, net neutral.
Right, and yeah, maybe I should back that statement off based on who's going to listen to this podcast. But but yeah, that is, you know, that that doesn't carry as much weight as a personal message between two best friends.
Right.
And right, and so that does, yeah, that does kind of give you a perspective in how relatively basic we are at identifying, at computers identifying meaning in what we actually post.
Another, maybe that was kind of the words, kind of parsing through the words. Another thing is just with the videos and images, trying to understand what is going on in them is obviously a pretty tough thing to do. And of course, they're making progress in this. You see similar computer vision tasks in self-driving and whatnot. And I don't know, maybe there'll be some transferred learning from one domain to another, as well as Google and Facebook, they know that data is the moat of sorts. It's their defense. If other people try to get good at content moderation, they can be better because they have had all these tens of thousands of workers training and recording what they say and learning from them. No doubt that information is being put into a data set that is being used to quote unquote train an algorithm to be better at doing the same task that those moderators are doing. That being said, since they're only flagging right now content, it's clear, and they're potentially not even very good at that, or at least only good in a couple domains, because they're so early in that process. It seems to be a very long time before the algorithm will make that final human decision of go, no, go with a piece of content. So they seem to be making progress, but I don't know if it's going to be another, 10 years before something actually useful happens, or if it'll be longer or shorter, or maybe the game changes before they even get to roll out some big algorithm to do some automatic content moderation.
Right. So besides technology, and we're not going to, unlike the last miniseries, we're not going to dive into the weeds of the technology. Backing up and looking at the big players again, like the governments, where do we see them going in the future? Where do we see these governments tomorrow?
Yeah, so how I kind of paint a picture where I think the governments most likely, this is just one possibility. This is just one result on the Plinko board of dropping the future that is our little circle and having it plink down. I kind of paint a possible future where I think the governments, and they're already starting to show this, they are demanding more stringent content moderation. We see that in this Earnit bill. You see the European Union trying to build their own sort of high regulation, which they've already showed that they want to do with their GDPR that went into effect in the past couple of years. So we think that governments will somehow demand more stringent content moderation, as well as potentially some of these governments are stronger than we think. Since I see the social media companies, they're teaming up in that Pakistan case, and in Australia they have a similar one. I see that potentially being that they're throwing their weight around, but they're maybe not as strong as they want to be, which is why they have to team up.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I think stringent will also be different across different nations. So maybe the Chinas of the world or the US, there are so many people, so many customers, so much engagement within those borders that those countries will be able to set the stringency differently. China, of course, will want to set it more towards their regime, the US towards our ideals, our regime, however you want to think about that. So I think that the government is going to tend that way. Another kind of subsequent piece is I think that we just talked about the current technology for this automatic content moderation being pretty bad. But I think it will get a lot better. I think the AI flagging and filtering will become formidable. That being said, I don't think that the human will always be, will ever be outside the loop. Maybe long-term, but in the next, say, 15, 20 years, probably not the case. But because their filtering is formidable, because they've had to do the strict, stringent content moderation from the governments, I think that technology companies will actually start to sell their content moderation as a web service. So you see this for GDPR. A lot of people predicted that the companies that will actually benefit the most will be the big companies who have the infrastructure to implement the rules and regulations that were, you know, user privacy laws and being able to delete and port things. So Google became stronger as a result. I think that if you see stringent content moderation rules, you will see the Googles, YouTube, Facebook, etc., being stronger due to having the only great content moderation service.
Mm-hmm.
So any future social media networks will probably, they'll probably pop up, but they will probably pop up only by using one of these big tech companies. And there's Amazon, I'm sure will get in the game or is actually in the game. So is Alibaba, a Chinese company, Microsoft. So I see new networks is probably popping up. Some of that will probably be just due to the internal discourse of a social media network, where it's kind of amazing to me that people of such different viewpoints are all still using Facebook. We talk about the filter bubble problem being an issue, and that kind of allows different groups to coexist on such a big network. But I think you will see more networks pop up probably due to each individual viewpoint. That being said, I think that the size of those subsequent new company or new social media networks, the more fringe viewpoint, probably the smaller the group, the 8chans and 4chans of the world will probably be here to stay under different names and always changing groups.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at the end of the day, you see this like fragmentation of the group. I think you and I and everyone will still have probably a Facebook and a YouTube account, but we'll probably be taking more of our content to some of these smaller domains where we feel our voice is more accepted, matches what we want. They're in groups that we want to support.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. So you are kind of envisioning much more of a lot more options rather than having like a catch-all for everything, right? That's kind of what you're envisioning?
Yeah, I think more options. And I don't know if I would say a lot more options, because you have the network effects of social networks where you get so much value out of a platform because there's so many people on it. But you see Instagram, which is, of course, a Facebook company, has so many, I don't know if they're up to a billion yet, but hundreds of millions of users. That's a place where some people say, like, I just need to be on Instagram. I don't need to be on Facebook anymore.
Right.
All of my people, all of my network are on Instagram. Therefore, that's all I really need to frequent.
Right.
So I think you will see some companies bubble up to the top, but maybe some others fall. Maybe people will truly fall away from Facebook. I mean, you see young kids these days, some of them don't even have Instagrams. They're like, I just have Snapchat. That's all I need.
Young kids these days.
Yeah.
That was the most old man yells at cloud moment ever seen, John.
Hey, I can't claim to be one of them youngins and their Instagram or their Snapchats. I have Snapchat, of course. I probably had it before they ever had it. But you see fragmentation, yeah, even today, but I think that will continue to spread to some level, and the big boring social media networks will probably be more infrastructure related. They'll still make a ton of money because you know, Facebook and YouTube will have these content moderation services that they're able to sell to these smaller companies. But yes, fragmentation.
Okay. Yeah, and just to backtrack real quick, if anyone wants a good laugh, go take a look at Bill Belichick's different names for social media networks. It's just gold. It's just pure and gold. It's amazing.
We'll put that in the show notes. I will click on that in the show notes because right. I don't know what you're referencing, oh, but it's great. I can't it's wait fantastic. To check it out.
Okay, but anyways, you touched on China and their more authoritarian suppression mm-hmm. and kind of maybe a little bit of a darker Black Mirror-ish look at what this content moderation could become, right?
Right. I think all technology, we have to understand, can be repurposed and reused in other places. Astrophysics, the technology, is used in rockets, famously. So, yeah, you've done some reading up on how China potentially could be using some content moderation tactics for different purposes. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a very recent article, and again, this will be put in the show notes, that it's a Wall Street Journal article titled "Made in China: Censorship for Sale." It was released early March, so this is after the outbreak of COVID-19 or the coronavirus, and it discusses what's going on with content moderation specifically in China. So to touch back on this content moderation as a service, there are several companies that are already doing that. So Alibaba, I know you mentioned them. They actually just have their cloud division just has a bare bones content moderation package for $240. And how they're limiting that is basically the amount of data. So for the $240 a month, they will screen up to 9,000 bits of text, image, and video.
90,000?
Yeah, did I say it? Yeah, 90,000, yes. To filter out pornography, drug use, and quote-unquote sensitive political figures. So that's where it gets a little bit dicey. On the other end of their pay spectrum, you can pay $60,000, and that buys you a five-year subscription. And that flags about 15 million items monthly, or reviews 15 million items monthly, rather. So it's some of that stuff is definitely here already. The scary thing comes in when these customers, the customers are essentially setting what they do and do not want moderated. So for example, China is, I think we can all agree that they're a little bit more sensitive on the sensitive political figures aspect, where they are, there's companies, for example, one of their former employees came out and talked about a lengthy shutdown that they had. They were shut down by the government for different pieces of content that came out. They switched to using Alibaba's content moderation product. And one of the rules that they came up with was that, and this is a quote, "Now we just delete any mention of Xi Jinping. Even if positive," the employee said, "you never know what will be acceptable today and not tomorrow."
Wow.
So, yeah, that's kind of a scary viewpoint of, we can all agree that the pornography and violence shouldn't be on there, but negative mentions of the president, positive mentions of, you know, another foreign government. I think a lot of people should agree that that falls under free speech, but some governments don't agree that way, and some governments don't lean that way. And so that's where you kind of get this dark side of, what are we allowing these players to control versus not control? Again, if they're able to control, like we said, going all the way back to the beginning, 50% of our interaction is online. So if we're letting them control 50% of our interaction, that's a lot. That's significant.
Yeah, that definitely is. And what's interesting about that is Alibaba, huge company, they rival in their AI prowess, you know, Amazon, Facebook, Google, probably not quite as good, but, you know, are on the rise for sure. I wonder if their content moderation service ever becomes so good, so popular, that potentially the authoritarian ideals of China spread to other countries. What if it's set up that Alibaba or gets pressure from the government, or maybe they want to do it themselves, such that even though they're filtering for a US company, if you and I had a blog, Zach, for We Are Here Tomorrow, and had a thriving community and we needed content moderation services, might they say to us, like, we're going to do what you want, but we have a stipulation. Anytime Xi Jinping is mentioned, we're going to delete that content. You know, that's so possible.
Right. Yeah. Not only the spread of political ideas, but I know, and I think we're going to see this a lot more publicly in the future, is that China is coming under fire for the spread of the coronavirus. And one of the things that they're coming under fire for, the regime is coming under fire for, is that they... critics of the government are saying that officials use this automatic content moderation to suppress information about the virus.
Mm.
Yeah, essentially that they were trying to downplay the start of this epidemic. And if we would have taken that off, the critics argue, we would have had a much better hold on this pandemic.
Mm.
So that becomes very real very quickly.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't read much about that, but that would be interesting. I'm sure there will be plenty. Every country will probably do some, I don't want to use this term, but I'm going to post-mortem and understand how did they respond to it. And that would be interesting to learn about. And of course, China is known for this. They have WeChat, which is their, think Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp equivalent. And the tendrils of Chinese content moderation run deep into that app. And things are automatically filtered within minutes because people... there's so much strong feeling of controlling what is said, what the public perceptions are of the government. So just at net, strengthening that ability to maybe even pre-filter content, so it's not taken down within minutes, it's just never posted, it's not accepted, which I know they have a little bit of already.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I forget what stories this pops up, you know, every month or two, where someone tries to make a post about some hot topic in China and they find that they can't use that word in their WeChat.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that post can't go through, so they have to change their phrasing and try and get around it in some certain way. So strengthening that probably isn't great. Seeing the effects of that spread to the United States and other countries, also probably not lovely. So we'll see where the technology rolls.
Yeah, and actually Tencent, which is the company that owns WeChat, is one of the very few companies that actually responded to the reporter with a comment.
What did it say?
So essentially their official offerings is that they will filter for $9,000 a month, they'll filter 36 million images for pornography, and then content that is described as politically sensitive. And politically sensitive content is political figures, political spoofs, or famous political events. So I know one of the most famous ones in China, for example, is Tiananmen Square.
Mm-hmm.
I know that is across the board wiped from a lot of Chinese content,
right,
to essentially downplay that historical event. Uh-huh. But I mean, when you look at that, yet Tencent was the only one that really had anything to comment. Amazon and Microsoft were both reached out to about their content moderation services. Neither one of them, they both declined to comment on them. Baidu Inc., which is China's largest search engine, also said they would not comment. So it is something that's out there, and I think it's something that some of these companies are very unsure of the power they're actually wielding over the conversation.
Yeah. Hopefully things change enough that these companies get smart and don't create a dystopia of sorts. I think we'll be fine eventually, but there's some scary possibilities for the future. Do you want to bring this to a close? Do you have any key takeaways you want to share with us, Zach?
Yeah, so that's about all we got for actual content. Yeah, I think the key takeaway that I have is really understanding what you're doing on these social networks and understanding some of the different motivations of these players. As much as I think Facebook and other companies would like you to think that they're built around providing positive content, they're really looking for that engagement. So I think it's important when you look at some of the spread of these different information. So for example, on Instagram, you have the Explore page. Just because it's on the Explore page does not mean it's positive and does not mean it's true. It's being pushed out to your Explore page because other people have clicked on it. And and Instagram and therefore Facebook think that you'd click on it as well and possibly share it or possibly like it. One of the most interacted with videos on YouTube are lectures on flat Earth, which we know is obviously not true. But does that mean that YouTube is going to deplatform them or demote them? And should they be? I think that's a really good question moving forward and something that we should all kind of take to heart and think about.
Yeah.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, I guess one of my takeaways is sadly how little power the users have, especially
always
for these
positive.
These services that are so powerful because they have so many users. I think one thing that I might try to do a little bit more of is just try and spread out my use of social networks. So don't try and use just the Google products and the Twitters and the Facebook products of the world. But when it's convenient, at least starting with that, spread the love a little bit. I'm famously a fan of GroupMe for whatever reason.
Love GroupMe too.
My family has a GroupMe chat. That's our main way to chat back and forth. I could be using Facebook Messenger, but we don't. I think there's great products out there, and it's worth trying to support some of these little guys and create a little bit of competition. But as well, there's a place for government in this too, and allowing the government to have a say and thinking through where we should be going, which is obviously really tough to predict, but thinking through this CDA 230 more, trying to understand where you fall on that spectrum, I think is incredibly useful and probably some of the internet civilianship that we should practice.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, on the government note, I think not to get too preachy, but as we talked about before, we're not the clients. We are partially the product for these social media enterprises. And with the government, the government ultimately should have to answer to its contingents, to its people. So I think that does put us, I think people, it puts the population in a unique position to, yes, feel small individually, but as a whole, really be able to swing what we want. So if you want something to change with these internet laws and with these social media regulations, talk to your government. Talk to your local congressman. It's something that can happen. So I think that's always cool to think about that. At least we are not completely powerless to some of these organizations. They seem like large, magnanimous, untouchable conglomerates, but they need us at the bottom.
Right on. Well, I think that's where we'll leave everyone today. We covered a lot. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Yep.
Send out our newsletter and feel free to respond. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And again, yeah, any feedback you guys have.
Sounds good. We'll see you guys later.
Peace out.
Hello, everybody. This is John again. Thank you for listening. That concludes everything we wanted to discuss in the episode. Before you go, we want to encourage you to join and participate in the newsletter that accompanies this podcast, specifically this episode. If you're not familiar, we have a newsletter where Zach and I will ask and answer a question and then elicit responses if you are comfortable from the audience. We will then put those responses into the following week's newsletter and ask a new question that builds off the next episode. This week, Zach and I were stunned by some of the dark costs that free websites have. Of course, these websites don't have to be free. We want to know what free online website or tool is the most valuable to you. Now, if that service suddenly required a monthly fee like Netflix, how much would you be willing to pay for that service? $3 a month? $10 a month? $30? Also, if any, how much more would you be willing to pay for zero ads and zero selling of user data for that service? To access and sign up for that newsletter, go to our website, wearehertomorrow.com. There you can subscribe to our newsletter, immediately get the current edition, and respond to the email to join the conversation.